And a couple of quick corrections. The next debate is Wednesday night, not Tuesday night, as I said in the last segment. I apologize for that. And somebody called to remind us that Al Gore was born in the District of Columbia, not a state. So, well, we'll get that right. Anyway, thanks very much for all of that. If you walk into the Wexner Center for the Arts here at Ohio State University, you'll see screen tests, celebrity portraits, a couple arguing at a breakfast table in a 30-minute Verite-style film, 700 pieces of art, posters, movies, TV, magazines, interviews that anticipate YouTube, reality TV, celeb culture, the product of an artist who famously said that in the future everybody will be world famous for 15 minutes. The exhibit is called Andy Warhol, Other Voices, Other Rooms. Sherry Geldin is director of the Wexner Center for the Arts. She brought the Warhol exhibit to Columbus for its only show in the United States, and she joins us today at the Battelle Studio here at COSI. Thanks very much for being with us.
Delighted to be here. Thank
and
you.
We want you to join the conversation, too. When it comes to Andy Warhol's art, do you get it? And, of course, we'll hear from our studio audience here in Columbus. If you've seen the show, is it art? Is it commodity? Is it junk passed off as art? Give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our blog. It's at npr.org/blogofthenation. And there's links there so you can take a look at some of the art we'll be talking about. But I wanted to ask you, Sherry, why is it that Andy Warhol inspires even such questions?
Well, what's fascinating to me about Andy Warhol is that some 50 years after he began working and even 20 years after his death, he seems ever present. He continues to, in a sense, define our own obsessions with celebrity and with instantaneous kind of gratification and with proclaiming ourselves back to ourselves, reflecting our world in all kinds of different ways. And in some respects, as you mentioned, he really foretold our complete desire to kind of be everywhere at all times and to make of ourselves celebrity. After all, I think it's fair to say that Andy Warhol has, in some ways, posthumously granted me my 15 minutes of fame.
The celebrity, of course, that he was eternally most interested in was himself.
Absolutely. And he made of himself his artwork. And the fact is he was alternately revealing and concealing his identity in so much of the work that he did. What's unique about this particular exhibition is the focus on the film and video work that he did in the 60s. As the story goes, he was so sort of taken with the fact that Americans watched the assassination of Lee Harvey Oswald on television, and with the endless repetition of the Zapruder film after the Kennedy assassination, that he immediately went out and bought himself his first video camera. And the rest is history.
He also carried a cassette recorder with him almost everywhere and recorded, well, almost everything.
Absolutely. In fact, there are some 13 audio booths in the exhibition where you can sit in a kind of foam-covered niche and listen to everything from his mother singing to cocktail chatter at one of those famous parties that John McCain doesn't like to go to.
Let's see if we can get some listeners in on the conversation. When it comes to Andy Warhol, you've seen the Marilyn Monroe prints, you've seen the Campbell's soup cans, you've seen a lot of the famous work. Well, if you go to this exhibit, you'll see some of the less famous work, but also brilliant stuff. Do you get it? Do you get what Andy Warhol was trying to get over? 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. Joanne is on the line. Joanne with us from Wichita in Kansas.
Hi. I just wanted to say that I was so shocked and tickled. I bought an Amy Vanderbilt's complete cookbook at an estate sale in 1961, and the drawings are by Andy Warhol. You know, where he's carving roast beef. You know, there's all these very basic. I was just wondering if you could kind of tell me about that, how he ended up drawing in a cookbook.
I'm not sure specifically how he got that particular commission, but the fact is Andy began his career doing graphic illustration and advertising in New York City. He left Pittsburgh as a young man after art school. And his first job was doing shoe ads for I. Miller, I believe.
And some of the drawings in this exhibit are exquisite drawings of shoes.
Absolutely. I think he did have something of a foot fetish. That wasn't, of course, the only body part he focused on. But the fact is there are some fabulous shoes in the exhibition. And many other artist books that Andy did either illustrations for or kind of pop-up pages. He literally touched every aspect of visual culture, from album covers and artist books to all the things that he's much more known for, the paintings, the screen prints, the photographs.
Joanna, have you tried the recipes?
Yeah, and for me, I was just so tickled.
Whoops.
I didn't realize this is what he did, and I was delighted to see that, you know, here was this piece of Andy Warhol in a cookbook of mine. So that's all I'll take off.
Okay, thanks very much for the call, Joanna.
Thank you.
Here's an email from Tom, and he writes, I never got Warhol until I saw an exhibit in New York City in the 1980s. The full-size format really works better than the small reproductions in books. And I think he's got a point there.
Absolutely. Although what you'll also notice if you come to see the exhibition in Columbus is that Andy really treated every aspect of his artistic practice equally. So a single Polaroid image is as important for him as a large-scale painting or a screen print or a film or a video. The fact that the marketplace has since declared different kinds of values, including for paintings that are going now at well over $80 million a piece. This particular show really tries to illustrate for the audience the fact that he was very fluid in navigating across all of these different artistic media. And in fact, his interest in film and video was very influential in how he approached painting and printmaking in particular, with the multiple views and the kind of storyboarding and the framing and the repetition.
Interesting that next to some of these multi-million dollar paintings, some of them quite large, you also see some four for a quarter photographs from one of those booths, you know, at the train station or at the arcade.
Absolutely. And Andy was also not terribly concerned about artistic authentication and authorship, which, of course, is causing great problems for people today who are loath to find out that maybe something they thought was by Andy Warhol was, in fact, not. But he was among the first artists in the 20th century to really work almost like a Renaissance artist with an atelier, a factory. And in fact, he called the first studio the factory. People running in and out, both wielding cameras and paintbrushes and screen prints, as well as being the subjects of the films and the videos that he was making.
Our guest, Jerry Geldin, director of the Wexner Center for the Arts here at the Ohio State University, I'll get that right, in Columbus, Ohio, and they're running a marvelous exhibition on Andy Warhol. Let's see if we get another caller on the line, and let's go to John, and John's with us from Buies Creek in North Carolina.
Hi. Wondering if there's a connection to Truman Capote, the exhibit that is, because of the title. And I was also wondering if Andy Warhol, particularly his obsession with Marilyn Monroe and the Zapruder film, if he was influenced by J.G. Ballard.
The British science fiction writer, author of Crash, among other books.
There is definitely a connection, quite a deliberate one, to Truman Capote. The subtitle of the show, Other Voices, Other Rooms, of course, is taken directly from the Capote novel from, I believe, 1948, in which Capote is writing about a young man, an adolescent, kind of going out in search of his identity, and particularly his sexual identity. And this was something that Andy, growing up in Pittsburgh, very much related to. And in fact, when he first moved to New York, the story is that he would stalk Truman Capote until the writer, I guess, filed some kind of a complaint. Later on, of course, they became friends, and Truman is the subject of some of the works in the exhibition. I can't answer the question about J.G. Ballard. I have never run across any reference to that effect, but it could very well be.
Thanks for the question, John.
Thank you.
So long. Here's an email from Ray in Cincinnati. Without question, Andy Warhol took art off its pedestal and made it more everyday and yet special at the same time. It is fun, engaging, and challenging. And, you know, that takes me to what you're calling time capsules. These are what you think of time capsules as, carefully selected pieces from certain periods of history that are meant to be a snapshot of our world at that moment. Andy Warhol had a different definition.
Very different definition. In fact, the time capsules really first began as moving boxes when he would go from one studio location to another and everything would simply be packed up in a kind of withered cardboard box and stashed away somewhere. And after he died, there were some 600 of these boxes that were then discovered and cataloged. Every single piece of paper in them and the single time capsule that is on view in the exhibition has some, I don't know, 300 or 400 different items
but
in it.
These can be menus from Chinese restaurants.
Everything, receipts, menus, invitations, personal correspondence, photographs from magazines, notes on a film script, pornography, you name it.
Any indication that he intended them ever as a collection of some meaning that gathers from the collection of the objects?
It's not clear that he intended that, although I suspect that over the years, as his fame grew, he must have realized that everything that he kept would ultimately sort of see the public scrutiny.
Like Bob Dylan's trash, it takes on greater meaning. We're again talking about the Warhol at the Wexner. Other voices, other rooms. I stand corrected. We're talking with Sherry Geldin, the director of the Wexner Center. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And there's somebody at the microphone here in Columbus.
Hi, my name is Steve Menendi, and I had a question. I saw the movie Factory Girl, and I think that movie sort of suggested that Warhol's commercialization of art had a dark side. So in the process of commodifying both art and celebrity, it sort of made people disposable. I was wondering, in the process, I was wondering how your exhibit captures that side of Warhol's art and work.
There is definitely a quality to Warhol's work that is dark. He was fascinated with death and with disasters, as you can see from the paintings of electric chairs or car crashes or hospital scenes. And certainly the celebrities that he was drawn to have a bit of a kind of tragic cast about them, whether it's a Marilyn Monroe or a Jackie Kennedy following the assassination of her husband. So there was always a kind of undertone of kind of sensationalism on one hand and commodification, as you describe. Even the installation design for this exhibition treats the work much more as if it's on view in a store. It's arrayed on shelves, and the curator and the designer very much wanted to sort of represent his fascination with art as commodity by installing it in that way.
It's not for sale, though, is it?
Absolutely not.
Well, let's see if we can go to Lindell, and Lindell in Holland, Michigan.
Hi.
Go ahead, please.
I'm one of those people who doesn't get it. I think it's very bold of me to admit it. I have a minor in art. I grew up, I came of age in the 60s, and I just think he was very inventive in making money over a bunch of stuff that I can't get that excited about. If I could afford it, I would not buy any of his work anyway.
Well, maybe if you come to the exhibition, we can persuade you to change your mind. But the fact is, Andy Warhol is something of an acquired taste. It's not simply because he creates these endless images of familiar characters that you should feel you have to like Andy Warhol. I think for the art world, he was such a touchstone for so many things happening in the 60s. That really relate to our broader social and economic culture and the sexual revolution. In that regard, he was really more of a kind of cultural figure even than many artists were, in that he kind of lived his art and he became the subject of his art.
Lindell, thank you.
And I do get that. That I get. I just don't get why it's worth so much money.
Because somebody's willing to pay it. Thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. And let's see if we can get Robert on the line. And Robert's with us from Philadelphia.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. So I'm going to say that I do get Andy Warhol. I don't get Matt, but I get Andy Warhol in the context of, you know, as you all were just talking about, the commercialization of art. I think that what he's been able to do is more reflected in his debt, first of all. You know, now we have artists making more money while they're living than they ever were, as well as, you know, artists like Murakami who are able to do these commercial art projects, and they're consumed as art, even though they're meant to be commercial. And, you know, I look at Andy Warhol as kind of a continuation of Aaron Douglas from the Harlem Renaissance, and sort of, you know, as you mentioned with the workshop and the collective nature of how he created and how he helped others create, I think that as an artist, you know, just as an artist, this abstract individual who creates art, he's helped to create this image that's popularly accepted as art, as what an artist is. And so by virtue of that, I think that that's what makes him, you know, an artist, or makes what he creates art, despite the purpose.
Robert, thanks very much for the call. A lot of people will get it, I think, if they get a chance to see this exhibition. Sherry, thanks very much for coming in today to talk to us about it.
My pleasure.
Sherry Geldin is the director of the Wexner Center for the Arts. She joined us here at the Battelle Studio at WOSU at COSI, a science and technology museum in Columbus, Ohio. Thanks for joining us, and thanks to our audience here for being with us today. Talk of the Nation was produced today by David Gura and Barry Hardiman. Our director, Gwen Uten, our broadcast engineered by Drew Reynolds, Kurt Stallnaker, and Kevin Waite. Special thanks to WOSU Public Media General Manager Tom Ryland, WOSU Radio Manager Tim Eby, Marketing Manager Carl Higginbotham, and the entire staff of WOSU Public Media. Tomorrow we continue our Ohio road trip. Join us for a broadcast from Athens, Ohio. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan in Columbus.